Good evening, everyone, and thank you for that great introduction. And also, I want to thank the previous presenters for giving great talks about the physical food environment, some of the issues of access in low-income communities. And also, I want to thank my colleagues who were my dissertation committee. This work is part of a larger study which looked at determinants of diet among rural women, and we did look at a number of factors, and for this specific talk, we'll talk about some of the specific social factors that were really important for this population. And so looking at the social food environment as opposed to the physical food environment. I have no disclosures. The purpose of this study overall was to explore, in general, the determinants of diet among rural-dwelling women in the southern U.S., and we wanted to, as I mentioned, identify the specific factors that influence food choice for this population, and a focus on focus on the social environment was really important for us to try to uncover. So first I want to talk about why this population was important, and specifically for rural adults and rural women, they have some specific disparities in terms of diet and obesity. In terms of obesity, the prevalence among rural adults is significantly higher compared to urban adults. For women, we see that obesity rates over time have been increasing significantly compared to men, where those rates, while they might be high, have not seen a significant increase over time. So additionally, focus on women and some of the unique situations that they might encounter in their daily lives and how those might influence their food choice and ultimately their weight status was important to us. Additionally, in terms of diet, rural populations tend to have poor diets compared to national averages. One study found that less than 2% of rural adults actually consumed a diet that was considered healthy based on a measure of diet quality, the Healthy Eating Index. And in general, another study found that rural adults have higher diets that are higher in fat compared to urban adults. So these factors combined made this population particularly important. And in rural populations, when we think of diet, obesity, diet quality, some of these disparities might seem counterintuitive. If you think about people living in open spaces, having a lot of room to move around, engage in physical activity, possibly have better access to fresh fruits and vegetables, we intuitively might not think that this is a population that we need to focus on or that might have health disparity, but the literature has indicated otherwise. And then in terms of focusing on the social environment, there's been a lot of great work in terms of looking at the physical food environment, as we saw with the previous presentations. Things looking at environments such as food stores, restaurants, schools, and work sites. However, there's a slight gap in the literature when it comes to defining what some of that social, the social environment, and how that could provide an important context for food choices and how people live their lives and the things that are impacting diet and obesity. Specific literature regarding social influence points to the fact that this is something we should be looking at. A study by Christakis and Fowler found that, looked at obesity and kind of classified it as something that could be spread in the same way that you might think of a disease being contagious. So they found that looking at social network analysis that a person's chances of becoming obese actually increased by 57% if a friend became obese. So that in and of itself is kind of intriguing. And the really fascinating part about this study was that when you increase the social distance between two people. So two people are friends, and for some reason that friendship deteriorates, so does that risk of increased obesity. However, if you increase the geographic distance between two people, so the friendship remains intact, or that social relationship is still intact, but they're geographically different, so living in different neighborhoods or living in different states, as long as that social relationship remains intact, the risk of obesity did not go down. So that implies that we might think, oh, well, they're friends, they might be going to happy hour together, maybe they live in the same neighborhood, they have access to the same grocery stores, they might share some of the same health behaviors. But the fact that those geographic disparate or geographic distance did not actually decrease that risk of obesity implies that there is something really important about that social relationship. However, the literature is mixed in terms of what is that mechanism. So some studies have found that high levels of social control, so urging people to engage in healthy behaviors among the college population, actually was associated with less exercise. So not what we want in terms of trying to promote health behaviors. Another study found that social network attitudes that were in favor of healthy eating positively influenced a network member's BMI, so that's more favorable in terms of the effect of a social network on health behaviors. Another study found that perceived norms about how much food others had consumed influenced food take in a similar direction. So there's promising research in terms of the fact that this is an important concept. We still don't know how it works or when it might be helpful or when it might be harmful. So our research questions, we wanted to look at what social factors were in fact influencing rural adult women's food choices. And then secondary to that, we also wanted to look at those based on some demographic factors. So income, we looked at higher and lower income women, as well as race and weight. And as I mentioned, this is a small section of a larger study, which included looking at individual, interpersonal, and some community-level factors that influenced food choice. However, for the purposes of this talk, just talking about some of the social factors. We used a qualitative approach with in-person, semi-structured interviews. Our sample was primarily exclusively rural women in North Central Florida, and we used the census definition of rural. So that's less than 2,500 people and or a population density less than 1,000 people per square mile. All of our women participants were at least 26 years of age or older. The interviews were audio recorded, transcribed verbatim, managed with NVivo software, and we used the constant comparative methods for our analysis. Those two boxes at the bottom there indicate the different ways we looked at our data. So it was qualitative analysis. However, and for one of the responses, one of the questions that we asked, instead of looking for emergent themes, so themes that emerged from the data, we actually analyzed it in more of a quantitative fashion. So looking at the direct responses to a specific question, and you'll see how we looked at that a little bit later. Overall, the interviews were about 58 minutes. They ranged from 35 to 85 minutes. We had a lot of rich data from the women. They were very expressive about the things in their lives that influenced the food choices that they made. We interviewed 20 women, and we stratified based on race and income. On average, our women were about 45 years old, and you can see the breakdown of ages there. And while we didn't plan for this, about 50% of our participants were obese. So while obviously we didn't stratify based on this, we were able to look at the differences between BMI because we had an even breakdown, but it also indicates the fact that this is a population that does need some intervention because we were not looking for overweight women necessarily. We just wanted a general population to understand food choices. But it was something that was an issue for them, and a lot of them talked about in their interviews as well. And while many of the women were eligible for SNAP benefits, only six of them actually were actively enrolled. So in terms of our results, I'll talk about the emergent themes, which are the social control of eating behaviors and the direct response that we found for food choice priorities. So social control of eating behaviors. As we were going through the transcripts, we saw a lot of women describing instances where their close friends, their families, a lot of times their husbands or boyfriends were explicitly commenting on their eating behavior. So this became, we titled it or coded it as experiencing direct social control. Another thing we also saw in the literature was that a lot of women were talking about the different ways that they avoided, people, places, or things that would incite them to eat in a way that they did not want to eat. So initially we called this avoidance as strategy. When we went back to the social control literature, the things that we were seeing in our data were actually pretty well defined. So direct social control, which I'll define in the next slide, and indirect social control were the labels that we gave to the emergent themes that we were seeing in relationship to these two concepts. And then both of these themes varied by income, so they were different for higher and lower income women. Direct social control varied among women who were obese and non-obese, and indirect social control was different for women who self-identified as white or and black. So, go a little bit more into what we were seeing with those themes. So from the literature, Lewis and Rook defined direct social control as social network members explicitly persuading an individual to engage in healthy behaviors. And this was almost exactly the way it was described in our interviews. And it sounded a lot like one of our participants' quotes here, who said, "Especially my boyfriend, he kills me with it because he always says you need to lose some weight, and I'm like, I am, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to eat me a salad. And then when I tell him I'm going to eat something else that's not a salad, he's like, no, you said you was going to eat a salad this week." I apologize, I got cut off a little bit. So a lot of the women describe things like this, and as I mentioned, it was frequently from a spouse, a boyfriend, sometimes their children, or a very close family or friend. However, only one of the women participants indicated that it was a negative thing. In most cases, the women were okay with it, and it was something that they just—it's in the context of how they were describing it. It was something that they described as helping them stay on track. So it wasn't necessarily an unwelcome type of experience for them, with the exception of one. And this was exclusively among our low-income participants. So 61% of our low-income participants described this in their interviews, and none of our higher-income women described anything like this. In addition, of the women who were describing this phenomenon in their lives, most of them, 62%, were obese. And then in terms of indirect social control in the literature, this is defined as a person internalizing a sense of obligation to a significant other, and by doing that, trying to avoid high-risk behavior so as not to jeopardize performance of these role obligations. So these women were definitely describing things that they were actively avoiding. So they were just typical of things like women saying, "And we definitely don't eat buffets at all," or another participant who said, "You just don't get those good, wonderful foods, so you'd be inclined to have more or second servings, and I don't cook them like rice. I like rice, but I know," and once again it cut off, "I know that if I cook it, then it'll motivate me to eat more." So other types of quotes that were indicative of indirect social control or avoiding, women talking about if they had women friends over to their house who brought food for potlucks or tailgating, they would make sure to send the food home with them. They would have a plan beforehand to make sure that the food didn't stay in their homes. Or they would talk about throwing away food that they knew they were going to eat that would kind of get them off track. Or one participant talked about avoiding her mother-in-law because her mother-in-law would always try to, get her to eat more. So with very specific avoiding strategies. And this was primarily something found in the high-income women that we interviewed. So 85% of our high-income women of our sample described this. And some of the low-income women also described this, but those low-income women were also, a couple of them also describing both types of social control. And then a majority of the women, who were describing indirect social control, a majority of them were self-identified as black. So in terms of our direct responses, we asked women to describe what a typical day of eating was for themselves, and then after they went through kind of the details of breakfast, lunch, and dinner, we just asked why do you eat the foods you do, or, what are the what are the reasons behind those food choices? And the responses that we got were varied, but they also tended to vary by income. So very different responses based on income. Overall, when we categorize these responses, we see that health was the driving response, most prevalent response. So as a public health professional, we're very excited by this. We like to promote health. Convenience was the second most frequent response, followed by taste. Family history, which was a lot of women talking about the things that they learned growing up, the way their parents cooked, family history. And price and routine were the least frequent responses. When we separate this out by income, we see a very different type of picture, where that higher income women are actually driving that health response. And the only other response that these high income women give is convenience. And when we look at low income participants, we see that they give a variety of responses, and for them, taste was the most prevalent response. So this is important for a couple of reasons. In terms of how we measure or how we promote our health messages when we're talking about healthy eating, and implies that we might need to tailor our messages for lower income populations because obviously for them taste is a really important factor and health is secondary to them. It's not always the priority. So the conclusions from this study, social network members seem to play a role in facilitating healthy diets among rural women. We see the differences where direct social control is experienced exclusively among low-income women, and a majority of these women are also obese, and indirect social control actually is experienced among a majority of higher-income women in our sample, as well as Black women. And then food choice priorities, as we just saw, vary based on income status, with lower income women describing taste as the most prevalent reason why they eat the foods that they choose, and higher income women stating that health was the most prevalent reason. So the reason, the fact that these types of social control experiences differ based on income, one of the reasons might be that these higher income women may more readily internalize social norms of health, so there may be the behaviors that result from that might prevent them from deviating from a healthy way of eating in public and invite fewer comments from social network members. And then also the fact that majority of these women were obese implies that it's consistent with other literature where we see that overweight adults report higher levels of social control for their eating, but it also leads us to ask more questions. So is it that having an elevated weight status, being obese, actually leads to the invitation of comments from family and friends, or is there something about those comments that actually leads to increased BMI? So that's kind of a direction for future research. And considering the fact that, this seems to be an important concept, we need to think about how we can incorporate social network members into intervention strategies. And then just a final take home, considering the differences between low income and high income and the priorities people place on health versus taste, tailoring our messages, and potentially not putting a focus out front in terms of health, maybe making that secondary message for some populations might be more effective. And specifically, when you think about SNAP funding and cuts to overall benefits and restructuring of funding towards SNAP Ed, obviously when we're making policy and structuring those components, thinking about how we tailor those messages. Thank you. Only one of our participants who described it as something that was negative. And the rest of them described it as something that it was just part of their lives. And in most cases, it was welcome. And they described it as something that helped keep them on track. So For the most part, no, I would say.